record your conversation.
Now, this is KAZU FM in Pacific Grove, California. It's Mae Bressel, and this is World Watchers number 641, March the 19th, 1984. We begin the program, many of you are familiar, some of you are new listeners, with a brief description of what we were sharing last year, a year ago tonight, to see how the news was flowing then and the continuity between then and now. I was referring to part three of Gulf and Western Corporation. Charles Bluedorn had died last year. He was the head of Gulf and Western Corporation. And on part three, I was going into his travels from Vienna in 1942, at the time of the war, World War II, to the United States, and how he worked himself up to be 50th in the Fortune 500 in 1982. I was listening today on the radio and heard that cocaine traffic, not heroin or marijuana, cocaine traffic is eighth in the United States in terms of $40 billion a year. Right now, it's between, I think, Ford Motor Company and IBM, $40 billion in cocaine. I just saw the Fortune 500 because it's on the list there. I watched the travels of Mr. Bluedorn, and of course, a lot more comes out about these people once they pass away, because the obituary gives information we never would have otherwise. And Gulf and Western, the article about him in Wall Street Journal described his longtime associate, Arthur Lyman, L-I-M-A-N, who was a partner in the law firm of Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton, and Garrison. Now, Simon Rifkin is the attorney who set up TCI with Otto von Bolschwing. That was the head of Hitler's intelligence. He was over Adolf Eichmann, actually, came to the United States and placed Helene von Damm as secretary to Reagan, and she's back in Vienna, the very city that Otto Skorzeny and Mr. Bluedorn and a lot of other people came from. So I was showing the link, Simon Rifkin's office also. That law office is represents 20th Century Fox with Marvin Davis and Henry Kissinger's on the board, and Gerald Ford, and Madame Chenault of the Flying Tigers, and the late Grace Kelly. The continuity of Gulf and Western with Michael Sindone and the Vatican connections, and the office of Rifkin with TCI and with 20th Century Fox and Bluedorn. Then there was another story last year about Mike Burke, a happy Yank in Ireland. He was in the OSS with William Sullivan. He worked at Warner Brothers for 18 months when Errol Flynn was making movies there with Ronald Reagan, when Flynn was in the Gestapo. In 1949, he became part of the CIA and was involved with a planned coup in Albania. He worked with the CIA in Poland, Czechoslovakia, with anti-Soviet intelligence people working with our government, and set up the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus in New York City. He became president of Madison Square Garden in 1977, and then Ronald Reagan's first agent, early agent, Sonny Werblin, moved into the Madison Square Garden slot to manage that. And I was talking about the links of Michael Sindona to Madison Square Garden. Michael Sindona is God's banker. Somebody asked me, the author of that book, I forgot, Penny Lerneau is her name, In Banks We Trust. I remember the title, but several weeks ago somebody called and asked me about that book again. In Banks We Trust by Penny Lerneau. It has a lot to do with the CIA and drugs and the SS, the Nazis, and the links of the Nazis to American intelligence and the drug traffic. The connection of Michael Sindona to all of that, a lot of it is in that book that came out 1 year later. There was a $2 billion suit filed against Gulf and Western because of their economic shenanigans in Dominican Republic, 1971 to 78. And, of course, Mr. Bluedorn was very active with sugar and control of Gulf and Western in Dominican Republic. And then I updated the activities of Mr. Bluedorn with Sonny Werblin and Edward Bennett Williams, the attorney not only for John Hinckley, but for almost everyone from the CIA, from Robert Vesco to the chief mafia kings and Richard Helms. And Williams represents the 20th Century Fox Group, and has worked with Gulf and Western. And the interconnecting links of Ronald Reagan, of Hollywood, of Errol Flynn, of Paramount Studios, of Michael Sindona. A year ago, we were talking about those things. And as I say, Penny Lardue has this book out now with some of the interconnecting links, and I think you find them interesting. How many of you saw or didn't see, I don't know if you saw, on television, the CNN news, the story of Larry Flynt. He claims he threatened to put a contract out to kill President Reagan. He's talking from Butner, North Carolina, the federal prison. He says, "I want to kill him. I want to kill that son of a, you know what? If I ever get close to him, I'll kill him." Now, this is a perfect place for mind control. Butner is one of the most dangerous experimental places for mind control, and Larry Flynt is in Butner, North Carolina. He said that he's put out a contract to kill two federal judges, a dozen federal prison employees, and he said that he arranged the bombing of the Senate building that he was in Washington at the time the Senate was bombed. He was in Washington because a date was set for him to appear before the Supreme Court. But he's making these statements and he's being investigated for them at the present time. I mentioned earlier on the talk show part of this program before we began World Watchers that just 2 months before the deaths in Jonestown, I had on my regular program that there was this cult down in Guyana, this Jonestown, where he was doing mind control and conducted his experiments in such a way that members of Jonestown, allegedly a church organization, took signed confessions of murdering public officials. The officials hadn't died yet, but in case they did, members of Jonestown could be blamed, so that they were linked in some way with either provocateur action or kamikaze or whatever. And Jim Jones was certainly linked with the Central Intelligence Agency and California law enforcement and back in Washington, D.C. So these things that Larry Flynt is saying don't make sense at all. And furthermore, there is a big fight that I'm not privy to talk about to get control of the entire Flynt organization. I thought they were through the woods a few weeks ago. I thought the good guys actually won out over the bad guys, but maybe I'm too optimistic. Some people say I'm too optimistic. They're not that anyone is particularly good in the outfit. I'm not really familiar with all the things they did before. I'm not saying these people that published the magazines such as Hustler and Playboy and Penthouse, they have that level that I'm not familiar with. I'm not privy to everything that goes on. But there is a power struggle going on, and I think that they're going to have Larry's brother be made conservator of everything he has because of the mind control that's going on down in Butner right now, North Carolina. It didn't do me any satisfaction to hear Jim Good this week. I was down there and he said, "You were right all along about the things you said about what would happen to Larry." I don't want to be proven right. I wish they had taken my advice the very day that he went crazy and was drugged, before all of these compounding problems went on. But you're seeing an absolutely perfect example of confessions of intent to kill, claiming he bombed Washington, that he has a contract on the president, and it's going to get from bad to worse until they do a certain program. I outlined what I think should be done, but that doesn't mean they're going to do it, and I doubt that they will. I think there are ways to handle this. But first, you have to admit that the government is capable of those things and has done them. And it's documented how they program people to confess murders and do murders and erase the memory after the murders and claim responsibility for those things. And you have to, once you admit that they do this, then you can find out what happened to him. And the chronology is very simple. But I just don't have that much input there, or not sure that they believe that yet. And by the time they do it, it'll get from bad to worse. Now, I know you read the article about this David Mahonsky, who was in front of the White House this week. He was shot in the arm, and he was supposed to be wanting to kill President Reagan. There were several articles about him. I'm not going to have too much. But he was outside the White House, and they put him in a mental hospital. And he claims that Reagan and the FBI and the CIA and Air Force intelligence had drugged him. I don't know how or what. He said he's been in a mental hospital in and out since 1974 for 10 years, And he says the government intelligence put a bug in his head, which transmits everything across the country. I don't need to be in another nut ward, he said. The president had me in three already. They put him at St. Elizabeth's Hospital, where John Hinckley is. And he said his problems began 10 years ago. He underwent drug treatment in 1978. His family lives in Pennsylvania, but like all of our would-be assassins or alleged assassins or kamikazes, he traveled all over the country. Another one of these unemployed travelers that goes all over the place with no jobs or no means of employment, such as Mark Chapman, who shot John Lennon, or even John Hinckley, whose family was well off, but he zigzagged all around the country, various places with no noticeable means of support, not even from his folks. Now, along with this case, there was a story in the newspaper, the LA Times, that agents in Washington declined comment about the case, but Secret Service Director John Simpson told a congressional hearing in Los Angeles on the Olympic security that Mahansky had intended to shoot at the White House Thursday night. Now, it's very interesting with the talk of kamikazes from other countries or terrorism at the time of the Olympics that an Olympic committee is hearing the story about this particular person who says he has been in the control of federal agents and that they've ruined his life. He said the president and certain elements of the society filled me with drugs. They are dangerous narcotics. He says, like the communist world, he said, I've had about as much as I can take in America. And he claimed that they had a bug in his ear. He wants it out of his ear. He gets messages transmitted. You've heard this before. And there have been experiments on this. And he was in front of the White House. And these messages come to him. He has mobility. He travels around the country. He claims he gets messages. And then at the time that he was in front of the White House, allegedly as a threat, the shooting was observed, this is interesting, by four Secret Service agents and a Los Angeles police officer who just happened to be strolling on the sidewalk outside of the grounds. The Los Angeles police officer, Keith Bushey, B-U-S-H-E-Y, said he and his 11-year-old son, Jake, were visiting Washington. And he made some snide remark, if I want to go to Washington to see the White House, it's safer at the Pizza Hut. Now, Mr. Bushey refused to answer any questions. I might remind you that there is no Easter vacation or school vacation at this time in March that Mr. Bushey would take an 11-year-old son, just happened to be in front of the White House at the time that this particular fellow is there. He had a sawed-off shotgun and a bow and arrow in the car, but that isn't the important thing. The important thing is how he traveled, like John Hinckley spent a lot of time in Los Angeles, in and out, and could be working with people from the LAPD. But he had a lot of time. His name comes up at the Olympic Committee at the Security, and an officer from the LAPD is right there in front of the White House with a kid who's not on vacation, who has no reason to be there. This isn't Easter vacation or anything like that. And what a coincidence with all the threat of kamikaze and counterintelligence and agent provocateurs that when this yoke, who says he's programmed by the government, is in front of the White House, a member of the Los Angeles Police Department is there also, and this fellow unemployed is traveling again all over the country. It's expensive, even on the Greyhound bus. But he's traveling around the country, and then they're talking at the Olympic Committee about him and his past. I think that's pretty interesting. We'll watch more. They'll probably clam up on it, but these stories, this kind of a story, and the way they do mind control is interesting to me, and I hope it is to you. There was another story in the LA Herald this week. The district attorney is asking the death penalty for two officers of the Los Angeles Police Department. One officer was supposed to get the death penalty, years ago, but they reversed it in 1972, even wants to be out on parole. But two officers were hired for the slaying of a Thomas Weed in February of 1983 for financial gain. They were paid. Members of the Los Angeles Police Department were paid $15,000 for the murder of a Northridge businessman. And furthermore, Weed was the co-owner with Ogilvie, another fellow, of a Ford called the Ford Kennedy Laboratory. Don't you think that's interesting? A cytotoxin testing lab. This partner of Mr. Weed, who was murdered, disappeared. One body was found, one wasn't found, and they also were wanted to be, they were hiring for another murder, the another murder case that they were going to do. The fee was $7,500 to mutilate weed. Just to think of how Larry Flint was shot in the genitals and with all the interest in pornography or sex, or you can kill for $15,000. They went for the $15,000 fee, and they also had a contract on another person. They're charged with conspiring attempt to murder a 37-year-old dancer, Joan Logercio, L-O-G-U-E-R-C-I-O, to collect her $100,000 insurance policy, naming themselves as beneficiaries. So the Los Angeles Police Department has a man in front of the White House when this fellow is there. The fellow says he's programmed, and they're talking about this in L.A., and here are cops from the LAPD this year charged with the murdering of one man and being hired to murder another man. Now, when Ronald Reagan was running as president and as he won the nomination, I had sections of a book on the air on California, the first para-fascist state. And it's almost 4 years since I had a few pages or remarks of that on the air. But with the Edwin Meese hearings and the Los Angeles Police Department investigation into the officers and Western goals, and they come together, they're not separate. Edwin Meese, Alfred Bloomingdale, John Reese, Jerry Ducote, Western goals, and their German Vienna and German offices and the Taiwan branch all come together, and they're very important. And I'm going to do a lot on Edwin Meese tonight, and then again to continue on the LAPD. But I just want a few quotes from a book that came out when Reagan was, before he ran for president. This was by Kenneth Lamont. He wrote essays from 1963 to 1971. He graduated from Yale University. He was in the Navy during World War II. He died right after, I'll look up the date, it was right after Reagan's nomination before the inauguration. And he wrote a book on California, the first para-fascist state. And we can review these few phrases or even parts of the book every single week if you want until the election. But it's pertinent with Edwin Meese trying to get in to run the Justice Department. Hopefully it can be stopped. Goodness knows I made enough calls, and I hope you wrote some letters. I didn't have time to write letters this week, so I was calling Washington. Mr. Lamont said, I tried to avoid using the word fascism because it brings up an emotional feeling. Yet, he says, it's a matter of degree, and there's comparisons between Germany in the 30s and 40s and California in the 60s and 70s. And remember, California moved to Washington in the 80s. He said, we look nervously around for stormtroopers. We see the Hell's Angels, the John Birchers. Those are the ones with the LAPD and the hard hats. We wait for Hitler and Mussolini, and we get Ronald Reagan. The Birchers are not enforcing the Nuremberg laws. The Hell's Angels are not operating death camps. And yet he claims there's a danger lurking here, that you don't look for the obvious signals. Kenneth Lamont said something is happening to California, to America's Golden State. From La Jolla in San Diego, and that's where the Hunk of Loans and Edwin Meese and Pete Wilson and John DeLorean and C. Arnold Smith and La Costa, the crime syndicate and so forth in La Jolla in San Diego and the Golden Gate Park in Marin and Watts and Palo Alto, the symptoms are ugly and obvious. State leaders make a mockery of the democratic process. Open warfare is waged against dissident youth of the state. One-third of the population earns a living manufacturing bombs, missiles, and napalm and rockets. And he warns, a graduate of Yale warns about California. He said, and I've had this, I know, on the air maybe twice before, but there are new listeners, and maybe you don't know the book by Mr. Lamont called Our First California, the First Para-Fascist State. Very important book, published by Little Brown, and you can get it. I'm sure it's hard to find, but I'm sure it's available. He said, California is the distant warning system for the rest of the United States. He wrote that in 71. California is our window into the future. California is the center of the whirlpool where all the currents come to a focus. The reports from California in 1960s, 70s are the minutes of the next meeting. What is going on here? Something even more dismaying is the disintegration of the state that should have been the brightest and the best. In California, we are governed by charismatic buffoons, men so clownish it's hard to take them seriously as politicians, men who are not reluctant to use their tremendous power. One-third of our people who demand production of these various war weapons make it literally the health of the state. We are engaged in open warfare, and the enemy that Goebbels would have is our own people. Technology has triumphed. Public disorder is matched by an index of private distress. And public disorder, of course, Operation Chaos and COINTEL program was Edwin Meese. And he talks about the treatment of the Indians or blacks, the Chicanos, and the apathy and disinterest here, and the similarities between Hitler's Germany and how Edwin Meese and that gang felt that the Californians, the young people, were the enemy to be destroyed. The Super Hawks run this state, and he gives them words in here that are not very kind, but can be repeated from time to time to let you know that this man, Mr. Lamont, was aware of this a long time ago, and the future has caught up, and it is the present, and we have to live with this, and the best way maybe is to understand the past. There was an article in the Washington Post recently, California County rapidly tightening their grip on the entire Justice Department. This was January 26th, when White House Counselor Edwin Meese moves to the Justice Department. Now, hopefully he won't, but think who else is behind him and Ronald Reagan and who they'll put in his place. We're not through the woods yet. It said when he moves, because they assumed in January he would move up, but he's already done the other damage. He will join a network called the Alameda County Mafia, made up of people who were once involved in law enforcement out of Alameda County. From 1959 to 67, Meese was deputy district attorney. His old friend now is at the Justice Department. D. Lowell Jensen has been promoted. He was one of these men with the COINTEL, Operation Chaos, the Squad 19. Lowell Jensen is second under Meese, and they're having a problem getting a special prosecutor because the justice is already stacked with the people from Alameda that worked with Ronald Reagan out here. Lowell Jensen is second under Meese, waiting for Meese to be approved. He was deputy director of the Justice Department in an investigative division. Deputy district attorney went on to be district attorney of Alameda County and then went on to Washington, D.C. Meese recommended that Jensen be appointed the assistant attorney general in charge of the criminal division when Reagan was president. Then he was promoted to associate attorney general, the number three job in the Justice Department. The Justice Department said they expect that Jensen, who is well respected, will fill in with Deputy Attorney General Edward Schmultz, S-C-H-M-U-L-T-S, who left. He left Washington, D.C., so there is no Deputy Attorney General except Jensen, and Jensen was put in by Edwin Meese, who has to be investigated. And so he worked close with him. Alan C. Nelson, Commissioner of Immigration and Naturalization, a branch of the department, was a Deputy District Attorney in Alameda from 1964 to 69. Nelson left that office and joined Ronald Reagan and served in the California Department of Human Resources. Another Alameda graduate is Lois Harrington, the director of the Office of Justice Assistance, Research, and Statistics. Harrington was a former deputy district attorney in Alameda. He didn't work at the same time at Meese, but she knew him and followed. Harrington serves as chairman of the President's Task Force on Victims of Crime. Roger Olson was deputy district attorney in Alameda County from 1969 to 72. He met Meese there when he was a law clerk, and when Reagan's administration came in 1981, he left his law office to become deputy to Jensen in the criminal division of the Justice Department. Olson is now deputy assistant attorney general in the tax division. Look how the tax was used by Richard Nixon and the same Watergate people in power now, how they can strike back or hurt. This Justice Department is run by the Alameda County, and it's not Alameda anymore. As Mr. Lamont said, California was the first parafascist state. Now you get the whole network and potential of a fascist nation. Olson was working is now working in the tax department and was in Alameda County. This is the office where the late Earl Warren, the Chief Justice of the United States, served as district attorney. Think what happened when a president of the United States had his head blown off and Earl Warren covered up all the evidence of the assassination that changed this country around 20 years ago. He came out of Alameda County. And on the judiciary, to hear Edwin Meese's approval or to vote against him, we now, somebody left me a message. I have a list of judiciary, but I hadn't looked up the names. I forgot that Arlen Specter, the one-gun bullet guy, the bullet 399, who lied about the physical evidence, the bullet that wasn't nicked, that had no blood or flesh, the one that was supposed to go through seven different locations, through John Kennedy and John Connally and Connally's wrist and thigh and come out clean. He's on the judiciary. Arlen Specter of the CIA is one of the people who will pass on Meese. Earl Warren came out of there. They were active in prosecuting student demonstrations, the Black Panthers. They hired the Hell's Angels to attack the anti-war people. And William R. McGuinness, McGuinness, is also a deputy to Jensen. And Marty Jenkins, a lawyer in the Civil Rights Division, was deputy district attorney in Alameda County. And James K. Stewart, director of the National Institute of Justice, served as deputy chief of police in Oakland. That's why I thought it was pertinent to repeat the warnings of California, the first para-fascist state, because the things that Mr. Lamont was talking about, those men have literally taken over various divisions of the Justice Department. Now, over the last several weeks, I've talked about Edwin Meese with his cutting down on the Truth of News, the Foundation of Education and Research up in San Francisco, his personal finances from his home, and the appointments of Mr. McKean to the post office and Mr. Luce to the, he got an appointment as an alternate to the UN. We talked about those with Meese. They're in the news now. And also the Superfund, his being vice president of Roar Industries that polluted down in Bakersfield, in Riverside. And Edwin Meese's control of news in Chicago when Rupert Murdoch moved in. I've done a lot on Edwin Meese. I talked about on Kazoo Meese and the stolen Carter papers before it really made the national splash, the headlines. But there are new items about Meese that I want to run through with you. Some you may have seen and some you may not have seen. Very important, before I get to the LAPD, which isn't separate from this, I want to share these articles about Meese because of the information that some newspapers carry and some don't. I can't assume that you get this material, so we have to run this down together. One story in the LA Times this last week, no cover-up vowed on the Meese panel. This is a quotation from Strom Thurmond, who works with Robert Gray, whose name was on the Carter papers with Edwin Meese, who worked with Frank Turple and was the Senate person in charge of getting rid of John Lennon, the memos on John Lennon. Strom Thurmond says no cover-up. The paper says that at least eight new witnesses will be called. I hope they bring 100, but they're starting at least, and I'll give you the names of some of them. What brought this ahead, the new matter, besides the old questions, was that $15,000 that his wife borrowed in December 1980. They had a stock purchase dated January 23rd, 1981, 3 days after the inauguration. Remember, several days before the inauguration, there was Richard Allen, who was with the president and had an envelope right after the inauguration that varied. It was supposed to have $100,000 on the outside, but then they said $1,000, and Richard Allen had to retire, was forced out of the National Security Council, chief advisor there because of that scandal. Well, at the time, Richard Allen was getting his little pays from Japan, and I had my theory about what that was about. I think it was delivering John Lennon so we wouldn't have any more protests when Ronald Reagan would bring us into the war or put the missiles around like he's doing in the bloodbath in Central America and so forth. At this time in December of 1980 and right after inauguration in 81, we now have two people involved with money transactions, but his wife borrowed this money. It was in her name, and it's a federal crime, of course, not to list this money. He didn't tell the Senate judiciary, and he didn't declare when he was appointed about this money. It's supposed, if you have $1,000 or more, you're supposed to talk about. The money came from Edwin Thomas, another man who later was promoted. He became regional administrator of the General Services Administration in San Francisco. That was the fifth appointment related to Meese at the time based upon these financial transactions. And now I have up to eight people that got government appointments. And it all had to do with his the money that he needed. to move to Washington. That was the alleged excuse. Now, a lot of people have moved from their home states to Washington, and nobody was more prepared than the Meese family. They had been waiting years for Reagan to get in the White House, so it didn't come as a surprise that they were going to have to make a move. We'll take a 1-minute break before I get on to more to the Edwin.